In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, yes, yes, it's movie time. Alan Adams joining us right here in studio on this Monday afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Good to see you.
Always nice to be here.
We were chatting about the Super Bowl eats there. You had some nice stuff.
Did some wings. Did a nice pull apart bread. Oof. Really just enjoyed the experience. Had a couple of nice cocktails.
Oh,
like really
very good.
Settled in and because you know and I'm sure you can appreciate this, but we had spent the run up before the game. We did probably close to 2 hours of the Puppy Bowl.
Oh, nice.
Like we really sat in and just were like, yep, we're just gonna
love the Puppy
Bowl.
We're
just gonna do this.
Now, did Stella watch?
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's she loves the Puppy Bowl. She loves the Super Bowl. Like she's definitely a football fan. That was really nice. We had a lovely quiet Sunday. Although we did spend the early part of the day seeing one of the movies that we'll talk about tonight.
All right.
On Saturday evening, we attended the opening of Trapped the Musical at Penobscot Theater Company.
And how was that?
It was delightful.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
A world premiere original musical with music by our friend Lawrence Fingerhut,
mm-hmm.
Starring a number of familiar faces, past and present, of among the many. Doug Mezwar made his return to the PTC stage. We hadn't seen him up there for a while. He was great.
And we had a couple of the out-of-towners here. Michelle Munoz and Maria Nello were in last week talking about the show.
Yeah, and everybody was phenomenal. The music's great. Some really catchy tunes. The performances were really excellent. Looks great, as per usual. The production values are top-notch. It was a really good time. I'll be writing a more in-depth review here in the next couple of days. But suffice it to say, well worth the time. And if you have the opportunity to check it out, you really should, because here's the thing: these things only premiere once.
That's right.
You know, so if you want to be part of it, mm-hmm. like this is your opportunity, and those opportunities don't come along as often as we might want. You should really check it out.
Excellent. All right. You saw some movies. What are we going to talk about?
I did. I saw a couple of movies. I saw one in the theater, and one at home. I went to see. Rich, I went to see Magic Mike's Last Dance. I also saw the Netflix rom-com, Your Place or Mine.
Oh, okay.
Starring Reese Witherspoon and Ashton Kutcher. I'm happy to talk about whichever one you would like to talk about.
I want to hear about Magic Mike. Come on.
Okay, so we're in a Hollywood landscape where sequels, series, franchises, that's the thing. Regardless of whether it should be, any piece of intellectual property that has proven to be popular in the past is going to be revisited. Mm. Like, that's just the nature of the beast. 2012's Magic Mike was kind of a surprise hit, low-budget offering directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Channing Tatum and a collection of fellas doing that strip show thing. 2015 saw Magic Mike XXL, a better than it needed to be sequel, although Mr. Soderbergh was not involved with this one. And now, 8 years later, we get Magic Mike's Last Dance. Soderbergh's back. He stepped out for the middle installment, but he's back for this one. And I will say, it's always been interesting to me Channing Tatum serves as a sort of quasi-muse for Steven Soderbergh. I don't think anybody gets better work out of Mr. Tatum than Soderbergh does. Salma Hayek is in this one. So, like, all the pieces are there. I'm like, oh, it's okay. So this will be pretty good. It's not really. And that's largely because of the script. And the truth is, it looks phenomenal, particularly the dance sequences. Like, you know, Soderbergh's always had a real knack for sort of capturing that kind of kinetic vibe, particularly when with this stuff. And it's like, whether we're talking about the more intimate one-on-one dance stuff or the grand production numbers, which you'll learn about why those exist here in a second when I start trying to untangle this plot for you. But that's the thing. The story being told, it's thin, doesn't make a lot of sense. A lot of details are either glossed over or ignored completely, and you don't really know why anyone's doing what they're doing. And so that makes it difficult, even when you take into account the fact that, I mean, we all know the story basically exists to kill time between the dancing. And I get that. But I'm going to need a little bit more, is what it is what it comes down to. The basic gist is we're told via, frankly, ill-conceived voiceover that, you know, well, times are tough. They're tough. They're tough all around. They're tough for instance, small handmade furniture companies, because that was what our friend Magic Mike was going off to do after he, you know, hung up his chaps. I don't know what you call them, but he obviously circumstances being what they are, he had to close his little shop, and he's back in the service industry. He's tending bar for a catering company, and basically just making ends meet. He is tending bar at the at a fundraiser for a socialite by the name of Max. That would be Salma Hayek, for a charity that is never really defined. Like, we don't really know what the charity is. I did not know at the time, but in retrospect, that was kind of a clue as to what was going to be going on throughout this film. We were going to get a lot of not enough information. But anyway, through a convoluted set of circumstances, Max finds out what Mike used to do, and is like, you know, I'm dead inside. Give me a dance. he agrees to do so, and He dances her so hard that she decides that, you know, he needs to come to London with her for a job.
That's a dance.
Yeah.
Wow.
And to be fair, it is, in fact, a dance that goes on maybe a little longer than it needs to as far as that goes. But again, I'm not necessarily the target. No. So I respect Mr. Soderbergh knowing what he's doing. Anyway, so the next thing you know, our friend Magic Mike is on a private jet, heading off to London with this socialite, and that's where we discover she's going through an ongoing and fairly contentious divorce from her husband, who is the scion of an incredibly wealthy media empire. Again, that's all we learn about what her husband does. Wealthy son of media empire. We don't know what kind of media. We don't know. We get no. It's a recurring theme, the lack of details. But as it turns out, one of the things that she has sort of gotten in this divorce situation is a classic old London theater called the Radigan. And the Radigan is playing this revival of this classic, this sort of classic British drawing room melodrama romance. She goes in and she's like, All right, Mike, here's what you're doing. You're remounting this classic British drawing room melodrama with, like, strippers and stuff.
Well, all right.
And that's it. That's the plot. And so we recruit a bunch of very, very talented dancers. Mike basically turns them into, a fancied up stripper crew. To do this show on this grand old London stage. Of course, there are plenty of people who are not interested in something like this happening.
I can't believe it.
And so obstacles arise and fall seemingly at random. Sometimes it's like, oh my God, this thing is going to prevent the entire show from happening. And then it gets sort of hand waved away in the next scene. And then something seemingly insignificant, it's like, oh, actually, this could undermine the entire situation. And you don't really know what's going on at any given point. But then the dancing starts and you don't really care. Like, and that's, I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, most people are not going to Magic Mike's Last Dance looking for Shakespeare.
Right.
Like, and I get that, and that's fine. And like I said, like, the dance sequences are really incredible to watch. Like, they really bring in some incredibly talented dancers to do this work. And it's great. It's all this stuff in between that's not, you know, and there's very little pop between Channing Tatum and Salma Hayek, and they're supposed to be like, you know, growing closer and whatever, and it's just not really clicking. There are some decent supporting performances from some folks, but you know, for the most part, it's like centered on these two people, and they don't really click in a way that you're necessarily. That lives up to what they're sort of what the script is telling us, and so it falls a little bit flat. Like, again, I had a perfectly nice time, and I'm sure people who you know, the Magic Mike stands out there, I'm sure there are plenty. They're gonna get what they want out of this. Tatum's like, I mean, he's better in this role than he is in just about anything else. Salma Hayek is doing her best, but I mean, she's not the script doesn't do her or any of them any favors,
right?
Soderbergh does his thing, and so it's obviously like well executed, it looks good, like all that stuff, like all the Soderbergh stuff is kind of there, but it makes you wish that they had maybe taking another pass or two at the script, like just to tighten things up and give us at least a story that we can at least kind of engage with, rather than just sort of throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
All right. So much for Magic Mike. How about this rom-com with an interesting couple? I'm having trouble picturing them together, and I'm wondering if there's any chemistry between Ashton Kutcher and Reese Witherspoon.
Well, it's hilarious that you say that, because the basic conceit of the film means that with two relatively brief exceptions, they're never in the same room.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, that's a rom-com. Okay.
Yeah. So the basic gist, it's the film's called Your Place or Mine. It's currently streaming on Netflix. Stars Ashton Kutcher, Reese Witherspoon. Directed by, I want to make sure I get the name right, this is a woman with it's her directorial debut, but this is a woman with real, like, legit rom-com bona fides. Like, she is Aline McKenna is her name. This is her first time in the director's chair. But this is a person. She wrote The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh wow!
She wrote 27 Dresses. Like, she's written some of the most popular and successful rom coms from the mid aughts. Like, so this is someone who gets rom coms, and it's like Ashton Kutcher, Reese Witherspoon. They've both had success in the romantic comedy space. But here's the thing, and we've talked about this a number of times, particularly in the last few weeks, just because it seems like there's been a spate of romantic comedies hitting the various streaming services. And again, like, I've as someone who rides pretty hard for the genre, like, I'm glad that the streaming services are reinvesting in that space, because I think there is an audience, and they're seeing that as well as anybody. However, what happens when you start making more and more, it becomes the dial starts to shift from quality to quantity. And so sometimes you're going to get, like, you're still going to get some solid offerings, and we've seen a couple of those in recent weeks, but you're also going to get some that kind of fall a little bit flat, that don't necessarily click in the way that you need your rom-com to click. And I'm sorry to say that this one kind of lands in the latter category. Hmm. Like, it's just, it's one of those, it's another one of those where on paper it feels like it should work, but for whatever reason, the pieces don't quite fit together. Here's the gist. We first meet our heroes in 2003. They're young people. Debbie, that's Reese Witherspoon, and Peter, Ashton Kutcher, wind up hooking up after a late night poker game. And it's a one night thing. They decide that they're better off as friends. 20 years later, wouldn't you know it, like, miracle of miracles, they actually meant it. And so they're still friends. They're best friends. They speak every day, despite the fact that they live on opposite ends of the country. Debbie still lives in Los Angeles, while Peter has moved to New York City. Debbie's a single mom. She's passed off her. She had dreams of working in publishing, but she decided to become an accountant because she needed to take care of her son, Jack, who is very much allergic to everything, and so she has developed into a bit of an overprotective sort of mother. Meanwhile, Peter is working. He's a consultant who specializes in helping corporations rebrand. He lives in a beautiful, empty apartment, has a series of short-term romantic relationships, and is generally just sort of moving through life. The one constant is, like, their friendship. Like, they talk all the time, like, and to the point where, like, people outside of their dynamic think it's a little weird, but they don't care. Like, they're besties. They've always been besties. They're gonna stay that way. And then, so Debbie has this opportunity. She's working on getting an advanced degree, try to get a better job, make more money, take better care of her son, et cetera, et cetera. But as part of that, she needs to come to New York City to take this, like, short-term class. So she's going to be there for a week, and it's a chance for them to be in the same place for the first time in many years. They're going to hang out, they're going to have fun, it's going to be great. And you're like, oh, okay, so I see where this is going. And then the babysitter that Debbie had lined up for Jack, a weirdo actress type, played wonderfully by Rachel Bloom, she gets a gig, so she has to go to Vancouver, and so she can't watch the kid, and so Debbie's like, I'm gonna cancel. And then Peter's like, no, you're not. I'm gonna come to LA, take care of Jack. You come to New York, stay in my apartment, and we'll do it that way. And so that's what they do. Remember what I said? They're not in the same room. Like, they're literally not in the same room. There's a lot of split screen stuff and, like, video chats and phone calls and stuff. Like, they interact a fair amount, but again, never in the same space. Which, for a romantic comedy, building this kind of movie around a central couple that's never in the same room is a bold choice. I can see a world in which it was effective. This is not that world. Anyway, so Debbie's in New York. She immediately meets Peter's neighbor / once upon a time fling named Minka, played by the wonderful Zoe Chow. She gets swept up into New York nightlife and starts, like, hanging out with all these people, including she meets the editor of a small press, this guy Theo, played by Jesse Williams, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, Peter is trying to help Jack by being a sort of a present male influence, trying to help him, like, you know, make friends, and, like, he's, like, encourages him to go out for the hockey team, you know, things like that. But as you might imagine, as someone who has spent his entire life single and avoiding any sort of significant commitment, he's not very good at it. And so there's some struggles there. And, well, that's kind of it. They both sort of spend their time in each other's houses. And, you know, stuff goes well, and then it doesn't go well. And look, Rich, I'm not going to sit here. Like, anybody who's been listening to this knows how this movie ends. Like, you absolutely know how this movie ends. It's like, are you sitting there thinking to yourself, huh, I think I know how this movie's, I have a guess as to how this movie's going to end. I'll stop you right there. You're correct. You are correct. Because that's the thing. It's like, and I've talked about this before. There are some benefits to predictability. It's not necessarily sometimes it can be a feature rather than a bug when it comes to romantic comedies. There's a comfort food aspect to it. Mm-hmm. However, like it just needs to have you need to have something there, like something to hang your hat on, something to connect with. Otherwise, it's just like you're just going through the motions, and that's the biggest issue here. It feels like this movie is going through the motions in a lot of ways, which is, I mean, it's surprising because there are a lot of talented people involved in this project, and you would think that that would sort of lead to even accidentally falling into some, you know, some good work. And it's not that anybody is bad, although we talked about chemistry. Not that I think they would have developed any, even if they had been in the same room, but that separation like really precludes any kind of real like palpable connection other than the sort of pre-established friendship that we don't get to see build. So it's just like we have their sort of their meet cute or their hookup cute, whatever you want to call it. And then basically we fast forward to now, and it's like they have this 20-year backstory that we have no context into. They're fine. Like, they're both talented. They're both good at this sort of thing. So they manage all right. You know, the supporting cast is great. Like, Rachel Bloom is wonderful. Zoe Chow is excellent in anything that she does. This is no exception. Tig Notaro is in this as Debbie, as one of Debbie's pals. So we get to see her interact with both Reese Witherspoon and Ashton Kutcher. Like, she's great. Like a really solid set of supporting, you know, sort of a supporting ensemble. But again, like with romantic comedies, it's all about that central pairing. And, you know, when it's hilarious to think about, but, you know, spoiler alert, when you already know like 20 minutes into the movie that they're going to get together, despite the fact that they're never together, It makes it a watch that's, it passes the time, but it doesn't really do much more than that.
There you go. Alan Adams laying it down for us here on Pass the Popcorn. Thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
See you next week.
Yes, sir.